Carl Reiner got his start on TV in 1950, playing second banana to one of TV's first big stars, Sid Caesar. Reiner also wrote for Caesar's weekly hit variety series, Your Show of Shows. These behind-the-scenes experiences inspired Reiner to create the now classic sitcom, The Dick Van Dyke Show. It starred Dick Van Dyke as a writer for a variety show whose host was played by Reiner himself. Then Reiner left the small screen for the big screen. He acted in such films as The Russians Are Coming and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. He directed the movie Enter Laughing, based on his semi-autobiographical novel, then went on to direct Oh God, Where's Papa, as well as the Steve Martin films The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me. Reiner's latest movie, Bert Rigby, You're a Fool, is now out on home video. The movie is about someone whose fantasy life is totally absorbed in classic Hollywood musicals. I asked Carl Reiner if that was true of him.
Well, it's still true of me. I mean, I will turn around if I'm going out the door and I hear a Gene Kelly or a Fred Astaire number or any of the old musicals, I'll turn around and watch it on TV if that's where it is. And I do have a lot of tapes of those shows. I just, when I feel depressed, I throw them on and my wife and I just hum along with them.
Did you ever wish you were the kind of guy who could break out into song at the appropriate moment in real life?
I am that kind of guy. Terry Gross, you're one of the most. No, I sing and dance all the time, and I just can't stop it. In the car, I'm singing a little off key, but always singing.
This is a movie about trying to break into to movies and to the stage. Was it hard for you to break in, and did anybody, your parents even, tell you that you were a fool when you were trying?
Oh, no. My parents were very proud of the fact that I wouldn't be a bum and I wanted to be an actor. See, they thought, they revered actors because when I was a kid, being of Jewish heritage, when you have an image of the actor, it was Edward G. Robinson, Paul Mooney, and then when they found out that Basil Rathbone was Jewish, they said, you're going into a good business. A lot of Jewish people go in that business. And they were very happy I became an actor. They just wanted me to be an actor in my neighborhood. They didn't want me to go away. And so when I did radio in New York and some plays in New York when I was very young, they were very happy. Then when I went to Summer Theater when I was 18, they were pretty upset. They said, you're going away to act? Why can't you act here? That was the only objection they ever had, though.
You started in serious roles in the theater, didn't you? How did you get into comedy?
The Army will happen. No, actually, I got into comedy because my first year that I didn't do serious stuff, I had done a Shakespearean tour. I'd been in summer theaters doing about 36 plays before I got to do my first musical variety review. And that was in a summer situation where I was a straight man actor in sketches. And I really took the sketches very well. Because I had a background of theater, so I played them real, but I was basically a silly person, so I was able to find the fun in it. And then in the Army, you couldn't ask people to mount a play for you, so I got up in front of a microphone and started doing stand-up material, and I really became a comedian in the Army. It's a good place to become a comedian. If you keep your sense of humor there, you'll stay a little saner than most.
So you were a comedian, but did you ever play, for instance, the Borscht Belt as a stand-up?
I started to. I went the first year back out of the Army. I started to do that, and I was an MC up at a Borscht Belt place. Actually, it was out of the Borscht Belt, but it was Borscht Belt kind of stuff, and it was in Keene, New Hampshire. And right from then, I had auditioned for that job in the Borscht Belt, but somebody looked into the room, a little glass window, and they saw me performing. And this was Herman Levin, who had done a big Broadway show called Call Me Mister, and he invited me to do the road company, remembered me from the audition. He actually bootlegged my audition. He looked through a window and saw enough. I don't know how he knew it, but I went and did the lead on a road company of Call Me Mister. And then I did a lot of musicals after that, Inside USA with B. Lilly and Jack Haley, and then into Your Show of Shows, which was, again, review comedy. But it all started in the Army.
You did Your Show of Shows. You were one of the stars of it. You were one of the writers on it. And it really turned into one of the most important shows in the history of television. Did you have any sense?
Well, it was the first of its kind, and I think that makes it important.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first of its kind, and luckily it was excellent. I mean, the first of its kind sometimes isn't revered. It's just that you break some ground. But this was the first of its kind, and it was peopled by extraordinary writing and performing talent. Max Liebman had a great eye for selecting people that might be stars someday. And he found Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. Before that, he had worked with Danny Kaye, so he really had a good eye.
How did he find you?
He found me in a Broadway show. I was performing in a Broadway show in the first full year of his shows was about to go on the air, and he needed somebody to support Sid Caesar. And I had been a first banana up to that time. I had been a leading comedian. And he invited me to become the second banana. When I had seen Sid in Tars and Spars and another venture on Broadway, Make My Manhattan, and I thought this guy was an extraordinary talent. And being a second banana to such a massive first banana wasn't a come down at all for me. I realized I was working with the best.
So being second banana to Sid Caesar, did he want to get all? Was he the kind of performer who wanted all the good lines for himself? Was he
a hog in any way? No, as a matter of fact, he was very good about the piece being right. And if you got a laugh, and if you did something funny, he would never say, "Oh, let me do that." He just lets you do it. As a matter of fact, Sid was the best double talker in the whole world. He'd double talk French, Spanish, German, Chinese, Japanese, what have you. And I also was pretty good at double talk, and I knew I would never get to do my double talk impressions. And so I came up with the idea of doing foreign movies. In the third week of the show of shows that was on the air, and it was such a success. As a matter of fact, that's the way I became a writer without portfolio. Up to that time, I'd been just an actor. And now I was just an actor, but who had some ideas. So I was always in the writer's room from then on. We never got credit in those days for writing. Actors were actors and writers were writers. But I did learn my craft working with those brilliant writers.
So you started hanging out with the writers and sitting in on all the writing meetings and contributing ideas.
Oh, it started in the third week, and it was 9 years of that. And I became actually a writer without portfolio. I considered myself a writer at that point because I worked on things that even was not going to be in. I worked on some of his monologues, and Mel Brooks and I did a lot of work on on The Professor, where I asked him questions, which was actually the genesis of my asking Mel Brooks about the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's another second banana roll that I relish.
In the writers' meetings for the Sid Caesar show?
Yes.
Was there ever an air of complete desperation where you had this whole room of really funny people, but they were just on the verge of killing themselves because they weren't coming up with what they wanted to?
Oh, I tell you, you're reminding me now of a moment when, after we'd been on about 2 or 3 years, and we had done 5 sketches a week for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that was an hour and a half show, and one day, on a Monday, we came in, and we sat around trying to fill some of the forms, and everybody came up blank. Everybody had dried up at the same time, and we all decided that was it. We said to Max Liebman then, we said, "We're going to come on the air and just sit there, the four of us, Sid Caesar, Imogene Coker, myself, and Howard Morris, and just stare at the set, and then we'd go blank, and somebody would come and say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, there is no more comedy. We have done all we can. No more. This is it. Good night.'" And we were going to do that. And we laughed about that. As a matter of fact, we decided to try a sketch where we started a sketch, like a vice president, people being ushered into a room, into a salon where they were going to obviously perform a sketch. One by one, they say, "Lord Trixton, General so-and-so," they come in, and they sit down on a couch and just sit there without doing anything. And we showed it to Max. We said, "This is the sketch." We just sat there. And he said, What is that? We sat for 5 minutes. And of course, everybody broke up. They said, "They're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there." We said, "That's it, Max. There's no more comedy. We couldn't come up with an idea." So we think we'd like to do that. America will tune in and say, "They're just sitting there. They haven't moved in 5 minutes. One guy crossed his leg, and that was it." We were that desperate at that point. Of course, that week we probably came up with the best show we ever did.
There were several of the writers on the program were Jewish. You, Mel Brooks, toward the end of the
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
That's a shock. Woody Allen worked on the show toward its end, and who knows who else I'm not mentioning here. But I was wondering if you were allowed to do Jewish characterizations, to have Yiddish words or to use a Jewish accent on the show.
I don't think we ever used a Jewish accent. I didn't know. After the war and during the war and before the war, it became people decided that making fun of any ethnic group was not good for people who were being slaughtered by somebody who thought they weren't worthy of living. So we did use a lot of Yiddish words, especially in our Japanese movies. We did As I remember some of the names, Shitaka Yamagura. Shitaka meaning strong, but it had a Japanese sound to it. Baron Kashimoto. Kasha is a word, as a food. But we always, anytime we used the Jewish word, we didn't allow that to lay out there alone. We always had another joke that everybody who didn't understand the word would be watching at the same time that joke was happening. We were very responsible to our audience not to do inside jokes that only some people would get.
I bet there were a lot of Yiddish-type sketch ideas that you came up with behind the scenes that you ended up tossing out since it wasn't appropriate for TV.
Well, as a matter of fact, the 2,000-year-old man was in the office with us every day, and every time we got bored, I turned to Mel and I interviewed the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, really?
Who basically was from the Hebrew persuasion. So we had that.
How did you come up with the idea for the 2,000-year-old man? What was the story behind that?
Well, it was a very simple story. I came in one morning, having seen something irresponsible on television, and somebody who actually claimed to have been someplace they couldn't have been, and I said, oh, that's a ridiculous thing. I don't know why they put that on the air. And in anger, I said to Mel, I understand you were actually at the scene of the crucifixion, sir. He said, oh, boy. And then started a 10-year interview that I did every time we got bored in the office. I'd turn to Mel and question about all the people he knew, having lived 2,000 years from Jesus Christ on to the present day.
Now, how did that end up being recorded and being done on television?
Well, we had done it for years at parties. We were always invited to parties, sort of like command performances, and we didn't feel we wanted to do that. We figured we had enough stature to be just invited to eat and talk, but I always brought a tape recorder with me, and I felt that I loved hearing Mel do this, and I wanted to have a record of it. So I had about 10 years of, maybe 10 years of this stuff before we got into a situation where Joe Fields, who was a big writer-producer on Broadway, he used to love it. And every time he'd have a party, invite Mel and I to do it. And he did it on the coast once, the West Coast. And every major star was there. And George Burns came up to us and said, you better put it on record or I'm going to steal it. Eddie G. Robinson came up. He says, make a Broadway play out of it. I want to play that man. And Steve Allen came up and said, why don't you put it on record? And we said, no, no. He says, why don't you let me pay for the tape? I have a little record company. If you don't like it, you can tear it, burn it, expunge it, whatever you want. And we did it. We did it in front of a crowd of 200 people, this whole ad-lib tape for 2 hours. We cut it down to 47 minutes, and it worked. And then we did four more albums after that.
Did you ever break yourselves up through an improvisation that you didn't expect?
Oh, all the time, because this was all ad-lib. The four albums we did were never prepared. We just went with an audience and just sat and chatted for two hours usually, and took the best of it. No, I was always off mic, giggling and stuffing handkerchiefs into my mouth, and sometimes not hearing because I was laughing. I didn't even hear what the second part was until I heard it back on the tape and then laughed again.
Let me ask you a little bit about the Dick Van Dyke Show. I've always assumed that the show was based on your experiences writing for and performing in your show of shows.
Did you come to that on your own, or did you read it someplace?
So it's obvious.
No, but it was. Yeah, it was based on my life as a writer actor on the show of shows, and it was my home life fantasized and satirized and lied about. No, but basically it was the husband and wife on the Dick Van Dyke Show was my wife and myself. I mean, that's all I knew. I knew no other marriage intimately. We've been married 45 years, and at that time was about 20 or 30 years.
Does that mean that when you came home every night, you said, "Hi, honey, I'm home"?
No, because usually the kids heard me first, and there's a car coming in the driveway, a dog barking, a big dog. She knew I was home when I came home. I never said hi. As a matter of fact, "Hi, honey, I'm home" was probably hardly ever said. I think maybe I used it once, because that was a cliche of all situation comedies, and I rarely used that. I mean, he probably said it one or two times, but most of the time we started with the script. If he said, "Hi, honey, I'm home," it was for a reason, not just to start a script.
Did you ever trip over the divan on your way into the living room?
I'm a klutz. My wife, I didn't do that, but I don't know how many thousands of times I stepped onto the back of her scuffs while she was walking, and I was walking behind her and had her trip forward. I think most men are klutzy in some areas. I mean, except for maybe Baryshnikov. I think Baryshnikov and Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire and Cary Grant never trip.
On the Dick Van Dyke Show, it always seemed like Dick Van Dyke saw himself as the sane person in the middle of all these really crazy people. Did you ever feel that way?
I always felt that way. I am basically always the sane person in a madhouse. Starting in the very, very first show on Broadway called Call Me Mister, I remember the producer saying, when I went on the road, he said, "Now, I don't ever want you to ask me for a raise because you're supposed to get great reviews. If you don't get great reviews, you don't deserve to be in this play. So don't send me great reviews and say you want a raise after you leave New York." And I never did. But when I got to Chicago, the reviewer had seen it in New York a few months before and said, "I'm not going to like this company any better than I like the one in New York." And then proceeded to write a glowing review of me, saying that I changed the show from what she didn't like to what she did like. And I said, boy, what a time to ask for a raise. And I knew I couldn't. However, I had a bunch of nuts in the company. They would tear phones out of the wall. They fought with each other. They kept coming to my dressing room and say, "Can I dress with you?" I had the star dressing room downstairs. "I can't dress with so-and-so." A real bunch of nuts. And if I told you their names, you'd say, "Oh, yes, you're probably right." Well, I wrote to the producer and said, "I'm not sending you the reviews, but I do believe I deserve a raise just for being the company psychiatrist. This company will fall apart if I weren't there to minister to it." And you know, he sent me a $35 raise.
Hey.
I got a $35 raise for being a company psychiatrist. So I really have the, I'm supposed to be the sane one in every situation. I really am not, but I certainly know how to play it.
The Dick Van Dyke Show has become one of the really classic sitcoms from television. Was it nevertheless a difficult show to sell to the network after you had created it?
No, as a matter of fact, the network bought it right away. They knew the quality of the show, and they knew the performances were very winning. Our ratings the first year weren't the best because we were on opposite Perry Como, who was riding real high at the time, had a wonderful show, a variety show. And they were thinking of canceling us the second year because we were only half sponsored. But Sheldon Leonard, our executive producer, got the other half sponsored. And I voted for a very sort of dramatic thing that was not being done at the time, to rerun it during the summer. I said, people who didn't see us can sample us now. People who watched Perry Como can sample us. And it happened. They sampled us and they stayed with us the following year and for the next 5 years.
How did you cast yourself as Alan Brady, the star of the show?
Why did I cast myself doing it originally?
Yeah, how did you cast yourself doing it? Yeah.
Oh, you mean Alan Brady? Well, I was looking for a major star, and I knew I couldn't get a major star to play a major star and giving him so many small scenes to do. So I said, I got to find somebody who they would think was a star. And then I cast myself. I said, well, I was a second banana, but I was close to being a star. And the first year, I didn't turn around. I used the back of my head. I used myself on a phone or under a towel when I was being shaved or something. And I didn't show my face because I didn't want the audience to say, oh, is that the star? He's not big enough. But by the second and third year, the scripts got so elaborate, and they seemed to like Alan Brady, that I turned him around and showed who he was, and it turned out to be me, and nobody was terribly disappointed, so we stayed with it.
My guest is film director, TV writer, actor, and producer Carl Reiner. Why did you end up switching to films after working in television?
Well, I had done 15 years of television, almost weekly for 15 years, and the bigger the screen, the bigger the challenge. And I grew up watching movies, and I knew someday to be on that screen. Actually, I got on the screen as an actor before I started directing in a few pictures, but the best of them being The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. At least I had a starring role in that. But right after that, I directed my first movie, Enter Laughing, and that was the most exciting thing of all.
You directed Steve Martin in All of Me, and that's the movie in which his body is supposed to be invaded by the spirit of the soul of Lily Tomlin.
Right.
And so he has to act as if his body is the shell for her.
Right.
How did you work with him on getting the gestures and movements on that? It was such a good performance.
Well, it was he worked very hard at home alone, having this human person inside of him, a female person. And it's funny, Steve Martin is another one of those graceful, ungraceful men. He has very big hands and big feet, and there's no way he doesn't have the ballet hands. And that's the only thing he missed. As a matter of fact, that's one of the few things I instructed him in, how the hand might be a little more graceful. But other than that, he came in one day and showed me a scene when the first time Lily Tomlin's soul gets into his body, where he was trying to walk like a man and the woman's sensibilities and soul would take over. And this schizoid personality when he showed it to me, it was just brilliant. He had come in and worked in the house with this walk and this half-man, half-woman approach. It was brilliant. And we just refined it and honed it, but it was there. It was very difficult to keep straight, by the way, to know when the man was in charge and when the woman was in charge. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about your son, Rob Reiner. He first became an acting star in All in the Family as Meathead, and then he became a director, directing movies like Princess Bride, Spinal Tap, Stand By Me. Did you ever expect him to go into show business?
Not when he was very young, although he had a tremendous ability to remember everything he'd ever seen. I mean, he was one of those kids who absorbed everything he saw on television and movies. But he never stated it loudly that he was going to do it. But in his heart, he wanted to be a director always. Isn't that amazing? And he only told us about it later. When he was about 19 years old, I saw him direct a... Ricky Dreyfuss and he were friends when they were in high school, and he directed a version of... No Exit by Sartre, and it was brilliant. He was only about 18 or 19 at the time. At that point, his road was starting to be paved. He wanted to be a director, and there was no question that he knew that, and he wasn't telling it to everybody because, you know, when you're young and say, I want to be a director, they say, I get out of here. And he had it in his mind, I'm sure, all the time he was on All in the Family. He was planning it.
One last thing. Does writing comedy help make life any more enjoyable? Do things, can you put a comic spin on things in real life?
Oh, yes, because writing comedy and writing it successfully, having your pictures made and people laugh at it, you know what happens? They give you money for that.
Right.
And you take that money, you buy a house, you buy a nice car, get good clothes, good food. Of course, when you get older, you can't eat the really good food. You got to eat the simpler food. But it does make life very pleasant.